is the Back Porch Education Podcast. Today on the show, Steve and I will ask and attempt to answer, how do we use the voices of others in our own writing? Get your education. Back Porch Education. Good evening, good morning, good afternoon. Steve?
Oh, let's just skip all the banter about whether you have a poem or not.
All right, it's Poe this time. It's not Frost or Wordsworth. We need to get more Wordsworth on the show, but it's Poe. This poem is entitled Two, and then there's just two dashes for, I guess, somebody's name. But the person's name is not...
To whomever.
Yeah. To
whoever it may concern.
Right, that's right. To not me. Okay. To you now. Okay. Anyway, this, we'll see, I think, why. But I think this is a good one for thinking about our writing and the role of writing and language and how other people sort of fit into that. So here we go. Two dash dash by Edgar Allan Poe.
The dashes are pronounced.
That's right. They are this time. Not long ago, the writer of these lines, in the mad pride of intellectuality, maintained the power of words. Denied that ever a thought arose within the human brain beyond the utterance of the human tongue. And now, as if in mockery of that boast, two words, two foreign soft dissyllables, Italian tones, made only to be murmured by angels dreaming in the moonlit dew, that hangs like chains of pearl on Hermon Hill, have stirred from out of the abysses of his heart unthought-like thoughts that are the souls of thought, richer, far wilder, far diviner visions than even the seraph, harper, Israfel, who has the sweetest voice of all God's creatures, could hope to utter. And I, my spells are broken. The pen falls powerless from my shivering hand. With thy dear name as text, though bidden by thee, I cannot write. I cannot speak or think. Alas, I cannot feel. For 'tis not feeling, this standing motionless upon the golden threshold of the wide-open gate of dreams, gazing, entranced, adown the gorgeous vista, and thrilling as I see upon the right, upon the left, and all the way along, amid unpurpled vapors, far away to where the prospect terminates. Thee only.
Leave it to Poe to kind of give you the creeps.
Huh? Right. It is. It's a little creepy.
But it's common.
It is.
To have something inside you that you're not sure how to get out.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think it's also common for us who fancy ourselves as writers to, you know, when you write something and you go, well, that's actually not half bad. Mm-hmm. And you sort of say, well, what he says is, you find yourself in the mad pride of intellectuality, right?
Yeah.
Like this sort of, I got it.
Yeah.
And then you're humbled.
Yeah, yeah.
Because a new thought forms.
Yep.
Maybe not a totally new thought, but a new thought. Something that you, now all of a sudden you're stuttering, you're stammering, you're failing to find words.
Yeah. Well, and so, you know, I kind of, alongside your poem, throw a story.
Okay.
of being in Boy Scouts and going to a, we called them jamborees, where
okay.
a lot of Boy Scout troops gathered together and had competitions, but also had places at the jamboree where you could go, for instance, fire a black powder rifle.
Okay.
Or see somebody who was a really good knot tier.
Mm-hmm.
But the fella that I'm thinking of today was this carver. He had a basic jackknife, pocket knife,
okay.
folding basic.
Yeah,
it wasn't
sure.
anything fancy.
Yeah.
And I remember him picking up a what looked like a stick.
Yeah.
And I watched him peel the bark off, begin making some parts narrower,
mm-hmm.
began forming it. And before you knew it, he had this interesting thing, this stick
mm-hmm.
that was now carved into a snake-looking thing. One end looked like
yeah.
a snake head, and it came to a narrowing end on the other end.
Right.
And it had the tail to it. And it just looked like he was just sitting there playing around.
Yeah.
And it captured my imagination.
Okay.
And about 10 minutes into my experience with a stick and a knife that I thought knife. Probably was better than his.
Right.
I realized that there was this thing called craftsmanship. And then this 13-year-old kid wasn't going to pull off what a 55, 60-year-old craftsman
right.
who had been whittling like that his whole life.
Yep.
And had probably made many types of those sticks.
Sure.
Art, really.
Right.
You know, at the end, mine looked like a stick that I had been cutting on.
Sure. Just looked like a kid kind of went after it with right. a knife.
And the interest was truly lost when I, you know, sliced my thumb. So, which he did not do.
Right.
I'm sure he had many years before. And then
yeah.
that I think, if we're going to talk about writing
mm-hmm.
and the craft of writing
right.
Or the motivation to write,
mm-hmm.
I just have to get it out there on the table to begin with that A, I don't have the pleasure of teaching much about the subject of original or creative writing. Most
okay.
of what I teach is academic writing.
Yeah.
But it's not unrelated.
Absolutely.
That
yeah,
there's
right.
There's a word craft
mm-hmm.
that's true of whatever you are writing
mm-hmm.
that must first, you know, the rules first have to be learned before they can really start getting broken in
wonderful
right. ways.
Right, right.
And so the question our mutual student has asked us to discuss this topic
yeah.
of how the voices of others work into our writing. So
yeah.
so give it your best shot. What's your first
yeah.
answer
for okay.
the question?
Yeah, I've got a lot of thoughts with this whole, I think you're right to start with craftsman, right? I would point to playwright. Playwright is spelled P-L-A-Y-W-R-I-G-H-T. And that word, right, just like shipwright, it means craftsman, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
So I think that's a great place to start. Thinking about the craft, when it comes to including others in your own writing, I would say you ought to do it early and often. You ought not be afraid of working other authors' thoughts into your own and using them as springboards or sounding boards for your thoughts. I think it's intimidating for a beginning writer because the greats can kind of serve as a wet blanket, right? They're just so intimidating.
Yeah.
That
yeah.
you just, ugh.
Why am I even trying?
And you, right. Because I'm sure to go back to you as a 13-year-old boy, you, after 10 minutes, look at that stick and you go, where's that guy?
Right.
I need this thing to turn into something awesome. I'll just have him do it, right?
Well, it annoyed me as a young writer. Let's maybe start there. I wanted to write because I read.
Yeah.
Okay, so it was the voices of others,
mm-hmm.
their written voices, that made me say, man,
mm-hmm.
man, the power of that.
Yeah.
The as Poe is saying, the ability to express something inside me
right.
in a way that, that transfers to somebody else.
Mm-hmm.
And so I had my favorites, and I had those that I sought to emulate or imitate or mm-hmm. or be like.
Right.
None of which, you know, this is the problem, right? The apprentice follows the master to learn the craft.
Right.
When he's learned the craft, he turns on the master. Right.
Yeah, sure.
This is not like he did. I don't want to be another...
Right.
Da Vinci,
mm-hmm.
right? I want to be my own artist.
Mm-hmm.
And so then, but if he's done it correctly, he's gained the skills, the tools, the wherewithal, the craftsmanship
right.
to be able to make his mark.
Right.
But he can't discount the fact that he got his start by playing around with... I mean, Poe is one of those for me. It's interesting you chose him.
Mm-hmm.
His short stories, I started out as really a short story kind of guy.
Okay, cool.
Because often reading for me was in the bits and pieces between the rest of life.
Between class, right, yeah, sure.
And he was mesmerizing to me. Mm-hmm. The Telltale Heart, and Gold Bug, and
right.
Pit and the Pendulum and whatnot were hitting a lot of things all at once for me. I liked mysteries. I liked trying to figure it out.
Yeah.
I liked, I don't want
to kind
say,
of the noir.
Yeah, not the macabre, but
right.
but something with a twist to
yeah.
it.
Yeah.
And you know, the notion of a man who's buried his
yeah.
murdered
right.
friend under the floorboards, but
yeah.
that eye just keeps winking,
right.
blinking at me.
Right.
I can
right.
hear that heartbeat still, you know,
yeah.
all these guys. He just led me along.
Mm-hmm.
And I wanted to write a story that would move somebody like that. It would be that kind of weird way. I hadn't thought
yeah.
of it that way. And then, of course, sitting down and trying it, you know, so this is what drives me nuts about a third grade English class that wants to teach creative writing.
Okay.
Why don't we wait?
Right.
You know, I've talked to our dear friend that's been on the program, Buck Faller.
Yeah.
You know, had a conversation with some elementary school teachers one time, and he teaches writing.
Yeah.
And they were like, well, you know, let's talk. Let's be a team here. We're providing you with your future students. What, when they come into seventh grade, what do you want? He says, I want them to be able to write a really good sentence.
Yeah, sure.
And I think that sounds low bar.
Well,
but it really, if you define a really good sentence as a
yeah,
a compelling, well done sentence, that's pretty good coming out of.
Sure.
We want to rush them to the originality.
Yeah.
And they don't have the experience to pull from.
Mm-hmm.
They don't have the reading.
No.
Right? They just don't have enough voices in their head. I think our
right.
question there is apropos. It affects us in part by being there.
Right.
If it
right.
isn't there, if you're trying to write out of a non-reading life,
yeah.
you're up against it, I think.
Yeah. I'm thinking a little bit here of, you know, training in the arts of war, right? You don't expect an 8-year-old boy to be able to handle a man's sword and shield,
mm-hmm.
but you give him something that it's not a plaything, it's real,
mm-hmm.
but it's fit to him
yeah.
so that he can gain facility with these tools. And when the chips are down, he can perform as a man as he ought to.
Right.
Going back to one of the things that you mentioned, I think finding those writers who inspire you, it's not nothing, especially those of us who read a lot. I think we can get so wrapped up in reading that we, if we're not careful, we can blow by the impulse to write.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's not good. Mm-hmm. You know, take some time to notice who is really encouraging me to, who's really encouraging me to write here? What sort of writing do I enjoy critiquing? If you're reading something and it's just page after page of, okay, fine. Notice that too. You're probably not going to want to write that way. But the stuff that you, whether you agree or disagree a lot with your author, they're compelling you in some way, yep. right? Yep. And it would be good to notice that.
Yeah, that's I sometimes caution myself and others about just reading what you like.
Mm-hmm.
I think you should, from time to time, take on something you don't like.
Right.
Now, there's a difference between reading something that's so awful that it doesn't deserve being read.
Yeah, sure.
And reading something you disagree with.
Right.
And I think that the arguing with a mind that's different from yours is very healthy. I'd say also when it comes to style, right? So there's, I see students fall into like a single genre. You know, I just yeah. read romances, or I just read
sure
whatever.
Yeah, post-apocalyptic, whatever.
Yeah,
sure.
And it's well and fine. I don't have any problem. I probably have a few genres that I in particular like and come back to a lot. But pushing yourself outside those,
yeah,
especially if you intend to be a writer.
Mm-hmm.
So to me, it's like the artist who walks through the art gallery slowly, studying the technique and studying the manner and style of others.
Mm-hmm.
Seeking that thing that is truly his own.
Yeah.
You know, and it is bits and pieces, right? I think the best writer is somebody who does have enough breadth of reading to have seen the tools of writing used creatively, and at some point some subset of pieces click and he's got his voice.
Yeah.
I just don't think it's I'm off by myself seeking my writing voice.
Right.
I think I find my voice best in the chorus of others.
Right. Yeah, having read widely is going to be key for a couple reasons. First, I think of recently with my students, we went through an essay by Annie Dillard in our class, and she is recounting being a girl and throwing snowballs at cars, mm-hmm. okay? Mm-hmm. And what she says, she uses in the same paragraph, she compares the marks that the tires are leaving in the snow to crenellated castle walls, okay? And then later in that same paragraph, she says something like, when a car would come by, we would pop it one, mm-hmm. right?
Mm-hmm.
We would bang snowballs together and throw it at the windshield, and it would make a starry something, some kind of weird star with a hump in the middle, right? And so what I'm saying is, she was pulling, when you can say pop it one and crenellated in the same paragraph,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
it's evidence of a person who is devoted to writing,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Devoted to words, and devoted to choosing words rightly. To sacrifice either one of those, either crenellated or pop it one, is to not as easily convince me as a reader that you're going to tell me exactly what you think it
right.
is.
Yeah.
And so as we're thinking about using either in your own writing or when, in particular, I would say pulling from other sources, other writers. Use the source that said it best, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. Especially in academia, we have a nasty habit of trying, of either sticking to a few sources, right? Or trying to find the most scholarly or the most whatever. Mm. And again, for the beginning writer, I'm not even going to push them that far away from that, because there is a corpus that is probably most helpful for you at that stage. But as you're growing as a writer, I would say don't be afraid. In fact, be bold and choose those authors who said it best, even if the register that they are in, right, their pedigree or their name, their wow factor, they don't enjoy the celebrity mm-hmm. maybe of some of the others.
That's why Shakespeare's so powerful to me, is because he's, as a playwright, he's got to sell tickets.
Yeah.
And he's got two distinct crowds that come to see his plays. He's got the highly educated, aristocratic, seated in the balcony, paid big money, you'd better deliver. And he's got the groundlings, right?
Right.
He's got the people that got in there for a penny or two.
Sure.
And he's got to write in a manner that keeps both with him.
Everyone has to be moved.
So there's these deep philosophical moments
mm-hmm.
surrounded by dirty jokes.
Yes, exactly. You
know? And there's this quote-unquote highfalutin language where he just takes the English language and stretches it in every direction with no problem
mm-hmm.
creating words, putting mm-hmm. words together that don't belong.
Mm-hmm.
Making words fit his meter, etc.
Right.
And then he's got simpletons speaking in very simple buffoonery, right? Mm-hmm. My students, I just finished Much Ado About Nothing.
Nice.
And so you have the some of the speeches of the well-trained prince.
Yeah.
Who is, you know, he's a leader because mm-hmm. his words are...
Sure.
Joyously glistening with all that is rich.
Yep.
And then you got Dogberry.
Yeah.
You know, who puts his sentences together with Elmer's glue.
Right.
You know, and condemns a man to eternal justification.
Right.
You know, or no, I'm sorry, eternal redemption.
Right.
When he means the opposite.
Right.
And gets all hung up.
Yep.
In particular on the written word, that mm-hmm. it be written down that this man hath called me an ass.
Right.
You know. And it's marvelous to see someone with that many tools.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and that's what's always amazed me, is the more I've learned about writing, the deeper and deeper in appreciation I can get in these other voices.
Yeah.
I'm a much bigger fan of Hemingway now than I was as a kid, because he's just so artistic. He's so fundamentally sound with a single sentence, just like Buck was talking about.
Right.
That man could write a good sentence.
He could
string them together into a story that's so basic and so stripped away of any ostentation. And then I flip to another shelf of mine, and I've got one of my favorite authors, Charles Dickens, who's slapping every word in the English language, and you know, it takes him pages to describe a guy. But when you're done, Mr. Micawber is alive.
Yeah,
you know
true.
Him.
That's
he's
true.
A friend of yours because he's a friend of Mr. Copperfield.
Right.
And so, you know, the all of these voices are egging me on when I'm writing, and I know mm-hmm. we're speaking mostly here in the terms of creative or fictional writing. But I think in philosophy, something that I dabble in,
mm-hmm.
That in particular, that notion of the great conversation, that men have been talking about these great ideas for thousands of years, and so you can, when you're talking with someone, back behind them is whatever philosophical school, if you've read it,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
you hear Nietzsche coming out,
right?
How many times I've shocked somebody when they've said, "Well, it doesn't kill you, make you whatever doesn't kill you makes you stronger," I'm like, well, thank you for that nice Nietzsche here.
Right, yeah, sure.
What?
Right.
That's the dude.
Right, that's where you
I would have thought that was in the Bible or something.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, not so much.
Right. Not
some things that
not
kill
the
you.
Christian Bible.
Some things that could kill you. It could kill you.
So, yeah.
But you know what I'm saying, that you start hearing Augustine, or you start hearing.
Yeah. For me, it's Aristotle.
Yeah. No.
Yeah, it is.
No. You know, Kierkegaard's always singing in the back of your head.
Yeah, sure. Like no. Kierkegaard is. Kierkegaard's the guy for me.
But you have those voices.
That's right.
A bunch of them. That are clearest to you.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Right? If I want to think about how to write a character, Dickens has to be talking to me.
Right.
Because for me, he it's there.
Yeah. If I want to think about how to write dialogue, it's Salinger.
Really?
Yes. The way that he puts dialogue together is just like, it sings, man. I mean, it's so good. I can't get away from his stuff. Yeah. Not so much.
Dialogue's interesting because you don't want it to seem like you're writing it.
Yeah. Well,
dialogue's a tough thing where it's only best when you don't notice.
Yeah.
That it's being written.
Right, exactly.
You're hearing it.
Right.
Yeah.
And maybe it's just that his characters are so wild. Like, I'm not thinking of old Caulfield in whatever the famous one is, The Catcher in the Rye. I'm thinking of, my favorite of his is Raise High the Roof Beams, Carpenters. And it is, the dialogue in that is just crazy. Yeah. I mean, it's so...
I probably need to read more of him.
Seymour is in the back seat of a limo in a bad situation, and the talk that goes on is just amazing. Oh no, it's not Seymour, it's one of the other brothers. Who cares? All right. So I would say one of the words that we've touched on a few times in a few different ways, I think this is another important thing to keep in mind, and that is original. Right.
Yeah.
There is a way of construing original to mean from the origin, from the very oldest things.
Yeah.
And there is a way of understanding origin that essentially means something new that you created. That is, you are the origin. Rather than trying to resolve that tension, I would say just notice that it is a tension. Mm-hmm. And hang out in it.
Yeah, this is the OED point, right? Oxford English Dictionary. Its amazing act is to not just define a term, but to try and show you how various people over the centuries have used it.
Right.
So it's a little different than the tools of writing. Now we're talking down at the units of writing, with these words.
Right.
But if I'm going to, if my character is about to forego the proffered sword, so you head off into the big rabbit hole of the OED.
Yeah, and
you've got
it is.
Pages
showing
you how others in the past, in the context of their world.
Yeah.
Have used forego, and how over the centuries it's perhaps changed, right? And now you're using that term with way more understanding, and maybe saying, I don't want him to forego it.
Mm-hmm.
I want him to refuse it,
right?
Or whatever.
Sure,
you're at that level of tasting and seeing,
yeah,
because you've got this. In many ways, it's like a chef who's just trying bits and bites, right?
Yeah.
That's one of the things that shocked me when I did a research paper on what it takes to be a chef, that the average individual who goes to culinary arts school, usually two to three years, gains 75 pounds
Wow.
off the tip of his finger.
Wow.
It's not that they pig out.
Yeah, no.
I'm surrounded by food.
Right, sure.
It's that
they're not eating 12 meals a day all of
right,
a sudden.
No cook
right.
worth anything sends something out that he hasn't at least tasted
right.
to know that it's right.
Yeah.
Enough salt.
Sure.
Whatever.
Sure.
You know, and so bit by bit.
Wow.
And trying all these different things, or the example in the culinary world of the sommelier, right? Uh-huh. This guy that's tasted all the wines.
Yeah.
Enough to know that goes with that.
Yeah.
And in writing, you know, you can fall into this sort of it's laziness, right? I'm just going to run this through again the way I did it before. But the good writer is constantly trying to evince it in some new way that I haven't tried before. That's what I see with many great writers is that they, you see them grow. You see their later work.
Right.
Who hasn't read Scarlet Letter, but I'm now reading one of his last, the Marble Fawn.
Right.
And suddenly, who is this guy?
Yeah.
This is not the dude that wrote that.
Right, right.
Because that was one of his first.
Yeah.
It got him the money so that he could be a writer, mm-hmm. right? And that now you're seeing this experience.
Maturation, right?
The master craftsman.
Yeah.
Right? The guy that I saw at 60 carving the stick.
Right.
Scarlet Letter's more like his, after I've been doing this for 10 years.
Yeah.
And Marble Fawn for,
right.
for Hawthorne is.
Yeah. I think that's right. I think one of the, let's switch to music just for a moment. I think that with music, one of the best compliments that I can give an old band, right? And when it comes to old bands, Pearl Jam and Foo Fighters both spring to mind.
Young man.
I don't mean that they're old. I just mean that they're older now than right. when they started writing right. music, right? I think those two bands, in my mind, are two bands who, when you listen to their latest stuff, you go, man, this doesn't sound like how they used to.
Sure, right.
And it's not a condemnation. Mm-mm. It's a celebration.
Yeah, good for you.
You're exactly.
You're getting better.
Right. You wrote some stuff
right
when you were
years.
Teenagers. But this is so much. This is what I expect of someone in their 40s.
Right.
Right? This is amazing.
It's the puzzlement with the Beatles, right?
Okay.
But 10 years, you hear their first album and their last album, and they don't even almost sound like the same band.
Yeah.
Because they aren't.
Right.
They did not wish to just write a hit and play it forever.
Right.
And so you wonder, you know,
yeah.
had they put in more time.
Yeah. Right.
But music is in an interesting thing to add. I think writing is this way as well, because so here's the thing. If other voices influence my writing, and they do, who influenced those voices?
Well, it has
what are
to
the
be.
Voices that are running around right. in Shakespeare's head?
Right.
And who was in...
Holinshed. Go ahead.
So you have this...
lineage,
and music is great in that regard because how often, in fact, some of the music listening platforms are built this way, right? I'm an Apple Music user,
yeah.
And so if I'm digging something, all I got to do is scroll down to the bottom, and it say basically, if you like this artist, you might be interested in these things,
right?
And I'm always looking for the one I don't know,
yeah.
And then I see that, and I click on that, and of course at the bottom of that is if you like it. And you hear this all the time, the inspiration behind our music, the influences to our music. You know,
right.
The Stones talk about Muddy Waters all the time.
Yeah.
Right.
Yep.
And they just say that's the dude. And even in genres, right, rock and roll is firmly built, really coming out of the blues, and jazz, and those are coming from. Or in more historic classical music,
sure,
you can trace. So he was taking what he had done and making it his own thing,
right?
And to me, that's the notion of coming up with something nobody else has ever come up with. stylistically or at the level of a way of writing, I'm not saying it's impossible. It just seems highly unlikely.
Right. And potentially tools, not that beneficial.
Yeah, it's probably going to come across. So my old favorite, Wendell Berry, talks about the fact that in his lifetime, poetry has become professionalized, where poets write for other poets, not to be appreciated by the layman or the seeker of beauty and truth, but to be appreciated by other poets.
He did that. Who know the secret key to unlock the thing, right?
Right.
That poets don't fill basketball stadiums anymore like Frost did.
Right.
And it wasn't and it's not because their poetry is worse now.
Well, you hear the modern poet now talking about bringing it back to the people.
Right.
Because they've realized what a folly that was.
Right.
Right.
Exactly.
Nobody, it's too small an audience. Mm-hmm. So I think as well, there's probably been, I mean, I pick up Jack Kerouac or something and I'm going, well, this is different.
Yeah. So It Goes.
Yeah.
Wait, is that, that's Kerouac, right? So It Goes is, Or maybe that's Vonnegut. Well, whatever. Okay, sorry.
Yeah, but you got these people in music. You have John Cage or somebody just sitting down at the piano and recording what happens when the audience sees him just sitting at the piano.
Yeah.
Well, that's not been done before.
Right.
Because it didn't make sense to people.
Right.
And in writing, you have grand experiments in trying to, quote unquote, break all the rules.
Sure.
But you can't break rules if you don't know what they are.
Yeah, that's right.
And so that's, to me, the notion of sitting a child down, saying, write me a story. You're going to wind up with, 13th place awards or participation awards or everybody with a sticker on their paper, because it's all kind of, if they're coming out of that kind of instruction, it's all going to be kind of collectively sad.
Right.
But if you really challenge them to first imitate, develop, work within some veins, some previous voices, and when they get pretty good at that, pretty confident at that, and understand the, to shift analogies again, how to use the hammer, when to use the screwdriver,
right?
What tools in the writing toolbox are appropriate. At some point, they do start going, but I want to do it this way.
Yeah.
And then it becomes art,
right,
as opposed to weird.
Yeah. Sure. And even if it's bad art, which that's not a problem.
Right.
There's no serious issue with making bad art
great
for a while.
Great artists produce bad art, too.
That's right. It's just on the way to the good stuff. You just, like you said, you're going to need that sort of grounding. I think I'll close us with this thought that I had from when I was learning Latin. My Latin teacher, one of the things that he would do is ask us to, when we were working on producing long sentences, which this isn't only on a sentence level, this is on a sort of idea level too or whatever, he would say, okay, tell me about Little Red Riding Hood, right? And so then we would say, right, in Latin, Little Red Riding Hood went to her grandmother's house. Okay, good. Nice and easy. Really easy sentence. Then from there, he would say, okay, tell me something else about her. She was carrying a basket full of food. Okay. Little Red Riding Hood, who was carrying a basket of food, went to her grandmother's house. What was in the basket of food? Little Red Riding Hood, who was carrying a basket of food, which contained A, B, C, D, E, F, G, was on the way to her grandmother's house. And so what we saw was that by starting with something very granular and adding to it what we could, As long as we had that important connective tissue, we could craft something pretty outstanding mm-hmm. for a bunch of noobs, you know, mm-hmm. like here we are not, with not that much Latin experience. And look at this. We just told the story of Little Red Riding Hood in a single sentence. And it's like 120 words long. Mm-hmm. That's really hard to do, but mm-hmm. we did it because we had someone to ask us the right questions.
Yeah, that's an important thing. Yeah.
Yeah. But I want to point to that. Adding in what you know and finding the correct connective tissue to put mm-hmm. it together.
Yep.
Sometimes you're going to be supplying the thoughts. Sometimes you're just going to be supplying the connective tissue and you're going to be pulling those thoughts from other places. But in either case, it's your writing.
Well, so I'm fascinated too. If I find a writer whose voice I really like, I try to find, if possible, something by him,
mm-hmm.
not some critic down the road.
Yeah, right.
But something from him
mm-hmm.
that talks about his art. Yeah. Right. So, for instance, A Movable Feast by Hemingway
yeah.
gets into his obsession over a sentence. Mm-hmm. I spent a whole morning on this sentence. It didn't come across that way, right?
Right.
You read the final product.
Yep.
You're not seeing all of the refinement, editing, asking questions right. to fill it out.
Right.
And you know, that's the fascinating thing to me yeah. is to sort of work back through what did it take to write that way.
Exactly.
One of the great little books I have on the writer's craft is Stephen King's little book that he put out for authors.
Yeah, I haven't read it.
But it's just really on a practical level talking yeah. about the craft and talking about the mentality and talking about, and when you read that,
mm-hmm.
I'm not saying I'm a huge Stephen King fan, but he is a good writer.
He is.
And then you start seeing the craft as a thing, as a piece of artwork. It's like the painter that's noticing the brush strokes and noticing the details of that painting. I'm not a painter, and so I'm just looking at the work of art.
Sure. It's pretty.
Right. The yeah. craftsman is going, how did he do that?
Yeah.
What did it take for that? How could I do something like that?
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. If you don't have other voices informing your writing, I don't think it's
beware.
What it could be.
Yeah.
Yeah. You're back to your Little Red Riding Hood.
Mm-hmm.
She's probably just walking to Grandma's house.
Right. Right. Yeah. Producing that story without it, the blueprint already in our heads would have been darn near impossible.
Yeah.
We needed the story to be well worn so that we could produce it with ease because we were focused on something else at the time.
Well, and I think we do discount, you know, one other work to bring in here just for fun is Aristotle's Poetics.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he lays out pretty much the rubric for every story.
Yeah.
And it hasn't changed.
Right.
And it amazes me how often I can sit, now that I'm familiar with that work, I yeah. certainly wouldn't call myself an expert on it, but I've interacted with it. And so if I sit watching a movie or if I'm reading a story, the voice of Aristotle is going, right. you know, now this is going to happen.
Exactly.
and it's exactly. Like, I love it when the artist riffs on it, you know, does the jazz move.
Sure.
And puts a twist
yeah.
on it, but it still had to be, I mean, the basic yeah. art is there.
Yeah.
And Aristotle is amazing in that he boiled it down to something.
Hmm.
I guess when you read Poetics, you go, man, it's pretty complicated. But really, step back from it, and he has simplified the art of telling a story into something that is fairly easily imitatable.
Right.
And then the refinement comes. How can I play with this? I think play is a big deal there.
Yeah. Yeah, me too. Well, maybe we'll stop there for today. Steve, as always, thanks for chatting.
Yeah.